We're finally learning which of Florida's long-term care facilities have COVID patients. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, a look at why Florida's senior centers are demanding more widespread testing for coronavirus. Do you have a loved one in a long-term care facility, or maybe you're in one yourself? Give us a call. Maybe you work at one. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, the return of the Jacksonville Symphony. It's coming soon, and something to look forward to. We'll speak with music director Courtney Lewis. But first this hour, here's the latest on the spread of COVID in Florida. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 27,058 cases in the state and 823 deaths. We have 35 deaths in this area, and one new death was reported in Duval County overnight of an 80-year-old man. Meanwhile, after lots of stonewalling, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis now says his administration will release the names of the state's long-term care facilities with active COVID-19 cases. Florida's nursing homes and senior living centers have been hotbeds for the disease. In fact, more than 20 long-term care facilities here in Northeast Florida are on the list of statewide providers with COVID-19 positive tests. Now, here in Jacksonville, one facility has sent a letter to the governor, the state attorney general, and the secretary of Florida's Agency for Healthcare Administration. River Garden Senior Services is letting those state officials know they're concerned about the lack of available testing for nursing home residents and staff. Marty Goetz is the CEO of River Garden, and he's on the line. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me today.
It's so good to have you on the show. And as we talk about Florida's senior population, its long-term care facilities, and COVID, what are your thoughts and questions, especially if you have a loved one in a facility and we want to hear your experience? Give us a call. The number to join us is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open too. Well, in a moment, I want to talk about the letter you sent the governor. But first, what's your reaction, Marty, to Governor DeSantis releasing the names of facilities, finally, that have COVID cases? They had held off on making that information public.
Yes, they have. And I think that's been a national issue. I need to tell you, I didn't send the letter to the attorney general. I sent it to the surgeon general. I copied it.
That's a mistake on our end. Thank you for that. Yeah.
And I also shared it with the Duval County Health Department. They had no choice. They needed to do that. There's been some horrific stories, many of them coming from the Northeast, around long-term care facilities, some nursing homes, some assisted living facilities. People were scared. In the absence of that, there is fear. We need to be transparent, and we need to speak straight to our communities, to our residents, families, about what's going on. Otherwise, they're not going to trust us. They will not believe us. It's absolutely critical that that occur. And so the governor had no choice. He needed to release that. I wish the information was a little more thoughtfully presented, but releasing it was necessary.
So in your letter to the governor and other state officials, you say, and I'm quoting here, we demand testing immediately, starting with those nursing homes and assisted living facilities throughout Florida that have already been identified as having COVID-19, and quickly expanding testing out to everyone. This is an urgent need requiring an immediate response. And you say, unless they can act more urgently, both residents and staff are in jeopardy, right?
That's correct. You know, this is not a political issue. This is what we are experiencing is the abject failure of public health in our country. We have underfunded it for decades, and we're experiencing that now. Roughly 25% of the cases of COVID are in the United States, coming up on 25% of the deaths. Roughly 20% of the deaths in Florida are of long-term care residents. What we are doing now, and the governor, to his credit, has launched some strike forces going into facilities that have clearly identified cases, hot cases of COVID-19. We're chasing the fire. We need to get ahead of it. And the only way we're going to get ahead of it, absent the vaccine, is by testing, massive amounts of testing. And so what the governor has started is a good beginning. It needs to be ramped up and ramped up dramatically. Everybody's been asking for testing, and folks have not been demanding it. And that's why I wrote the letter. My real concern, though, is that what's happening now is we open up the economy, and everybody wants to see the economy open, is if we are opening it too quickly, we're going to get a rebound that's going to put us back 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks. We have to start all over again. And that's a source of real concern. We need to be taking our direction from the scientists and the physicians who know best what we're dealing with, not the politicians. The politicians need to lead, but they need to be taking their, all of them need to be taking their direction from the experts.
So you're saying you'd like the governor to mobilize the National Guard and volunteer clinical personnel throughout Florida, a much bigger mobilization than what we've seen so far. And as you said, there are strike teams of the Guard out there. You don't think it's nearly enough?
That's correct. We're chasing the fire. We've got to get ahead of the fire. It's no different than the forest fires that were occurring out in California. You've got to get ahead of it. If you don't get ahead of it, all we're doing is chasing it. And it's an insidious virus. If you think about it, 50 days ago, there was one person, two. Now we have 40,000 dead. It's striking. It's stunning in its lethality. The only way we're going to be able to deal with it in long-term care facilities, and prisons too, by the way, is by testing and testing.
And Marty, what's the testing like at your facility, River Garden? And do you have cases at River Garden?
We have no identified COVID-19 on our campus. We've been screening at our guardhouse since before it was actually mandated by the government. And we continue that to this day. We also have required that the hospitals, when they want to refer us a patient for short-stay post-acute care, test that patient immediately prior to discharging them to us. Prior to now, hospitals have been screening patients and sending them to long-term care facilities. And what we have come to understand is that up to 25% of the COVID-19 that's active is asymptomatic, presenting as asymptomatic in individuals. So testing is a real concern. I listened at the beginning of the newscast. They're talking about the Abbott test, and a physician, I think it was in Cleveland, that identified about 85-86% accuracy. Clearly, it's got to be better than that to be effective. But we have done no testing on this campus, because it's been impossible to get test kits. And until I present someone who is a possible COVID-19, I can't get test kits.
So right. So it's a catch 22. You're stuck.
So when the argument is made on the nightly news coming out of Washington that anybody and everybody that wants to be tested that's just not been the case.
All right, let's go to some calls now. We're speaking with Marty Goetz, CEO of River Garden Senior Services, rather, and the River Garden Hebrew Home for the Aged. As we look at Florida's nursing homes, assisted living centers, long-term care facilities, and COVID-19, the people that run these centers are demanding more widespread testing to better protect their senior population. Do you have a loved one in a facility? Do you have concerns? Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Ted is in Mandarin. Hi, Ted. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling as a member of the community in Mandarin and also a member of a grassroots organization, Indivisible Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
Marty and River Garden are close to our hearts. We know a lot of the people there. We've met there many times, and we want to support wholeheartedly what he's saying and feel that it's time, it's past time for this testing to be done as soon as possible. And we want to do anything we can to support him in that.
Well, thanks, Ted. They need all the support they can get right now, Marty. I'm sure that has got to sound good to your ears.
It really does. Thank you, Ted. I appreciate the comment. You know, the most difficult thing, because we're 6 weeks into this now on our campus, is family cannot enter this campus. It's so quiet here. Our volunteer program has been shut down. I mean, this is a different place right now and has been for upwards of 6 weeks as we lock it down to try and keep everyone safe so that if COVID does find its way onto the campus, and it can, that we can manage it without it becoming widespread. Widespread is disastrous, as everybody knows. It's a real challenge. But I feel particularly badly for families because Zoom, and I've become pretty good with Zoom.
Uh-huh. We all have, right? Yeah, right.
It's fascinating. I had a birthday yesterday, and my kid zoomed in on me. It was really kind of cool.
That's nice.
But FaceTime, and I mean, that's what we're doing now, both in our independent living facility, the Cove, and at River Garden, because we need to keep families connected. And this is really hard.
It really is. And speaking of families, here's an email we received from Michelle. She has her mom in a facility in Jacksonville, and she has not been able to get any answers out of them, she says, to her questions. Here's what she's asking us. She says, in Florida, the head of Families for Better Care is pushing for family members to be notified when a COVID outbreak occurs at a loved one's care facility. There's been no requirement as yet to notify families. What do you think about that? Should facilities be required to notify families?
So my answer to that is yes, they should. And CMS has just issued proposed regulation for that, requiring facilities, nursing homes. They don't oversee ALF, but requiring nursing homes to give prompt notification to family members, and also to the CDC, which is kind of interesting, when there is a positive finding of COVID-19 in the facility. So that is coming. So speaking of River Garden, okay, and I would encourage other colleagues to do similar. We have been sending out almost weekly blast email messages identifying our COVID-19 status, starting with it actually, and then speaking about what we have done and are continuing to do, essentially to restrict access and opportunity on the campus. It's really it's been helpful. Our community has been very supportive of that.
And what about the community of facilities around the state? You've sent a letter to the governor, the Surgeon General, others. People around the state that run centers are doing the same. Have you banded together to lobby as a group in any way? Is that happening?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. When I did the first version of the letter that you've seen now, I was writing, "We are requesting," and I changed it actually after listening to some of the comments coming out of Tallahassee and Washington to demand it, because I'm not looking now to make friends with anybody. I'm not looking to offend anybody. I'm looking at outcome, and for us to be able to have the possibility of sustaining a positive outcome, nursing homes and assisted living facilities, absent a vaccine, have to have active testing. There's no other way to address it except active testing in the absence of vaccine.
And have you heard from the governor's office in response to your demand for more widespread testing at long-term care facilities?
No, I haven't, but the letter just went out last week, and I suspect he's busy.
Sure.
But I know he's got it. We also sent it to ACA Secretary Mary Mayhew, in addition to Scott Rifkus, and to the Duval County Health Department.
Carmen, meanwhile, tweets the show, "A friend of mine in Miami had a terrible experience. The Miami Herald covered it. It's about a woman who hadn't left her elder care home in 3 years, Marty, but she still passed away from COVID. Even though she was sheltering in place, taking every precaution, I think that gives you an idea of how easily the disease can spread at a senior facility.
Yes, I would agree with that. So at this point, Melissa, the only people coming on or off our campus are staff. And so given the opportunity to start testing, I would be starting with my staff. I'd be the first one to give a swab, right?
Yeah. And are your staff telling you they're worried? They're worried about it too, I'm sure.
Sure they are. Everybody's worried. Anybody that isn't concerned about COVID-19 is either a liar or a fool.
We have a lot of calls, meanwhile, for Marty Goetz, CEO of River Garden, as we talk about the state's long-term care facilities and COVID. The state is finally releasing data showing where active cases are at Florida senior facilities. But those facilities are demanding more widespread testing. What do you think? And do you have a loved one in a senior center? What are your concerns? It's 549-2937. Linda is in Mandarin. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning. I was just thinking that with the mayor and people all over relaxing standards, saying we need to get back to normal, if you know you have a vulnerable population, the two places you should be is at senior centers. And I live off of St. Augustine, so there are five assisted living, River Garden, assisted living, all over. And if their workers are asymptomatic, they're going to that neighborhood, Winn-Dixie Publix and Walmart, to shop. So we need to test the long-term care facility. And we also need to have a testing center on the west side and the north side where people who have to go out to work, they can't shelter in place, need to be tested and maybe asymptomatic going into work to make a living. Mayor, if you're listening, please, you know, step back up and take that on. Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. You know, Marty, Jacksonville has been ahead of the curve in trying to get testing opportunities available as compared to a lot of other places around the country. The testing site at Lot J at TIAA Bankfield has had people lining up almost every day to get tested. That said, despite what I think are the commendable efforts of Mayor Curry's administration, we are still only testing about 1%, a little more than 1% maybe, of the population. And that holds true across Florida. Widespread testing is just not happening. And who ultimately is to blame for that? You know, governors will tell you, from Governor Cuomo in New York to other governors around the country, that they've had to fight amongst other states for testing kits, for personal protective equipment. It's a jungle out there because the tests just aren't available in big enough numbers to test enough people.
Melissa, there's a reason why the Confederacy lost the Civil War. This effort for COVID-19 requires centralized planning that only the federal government can do. You have 50 different states and Guam and Columbia, District of Columbia, each trying to figure out what to do, and you get what we're getting now. I mean, that's what happened. It's interesting because when the mayor opened up the beaches, I thought that was probably okay. They opened them up with very reasonable restrictions. At least I thought so. When I talked to my daughter, who is a psychiatrist in Baltimore, she disagreed with me. She said, Dad, what we've just done, or what Florida has just done, is tell people it's okay, things are better now, go have fun. And I think we're experiencing a lot of that in our beaches now. One of the TV stations did a report on people driving here from Alabama to go on our beaches, mm-hmm. and from South Carolina. I mean, it's my fear, my real fear, is that we're going to open this up too quickly. And in 3 weeks, we're going to find ourselves right back to where we were. And there'll be a whole lot more New York City out there. And we'll have spent trillions of dollars and be facing the same thing again.
So to your earlier point that only the federal government can provide the international supply chain and the testing kits that are needed, when you send a letter to Governor DeSantis and other state officials, as you've pointed out, there are limits to what they're able to do. Is it ultimately their responsibility to test more widely at senior centers, given the limitations, as you said, the states have?
I would agree with that statement. But you know, I mean, they're on TV every night at 6 o'clock from Washington, and they're saying that anybody who wants to get tested can. There's plenty to go around, and stuff like that. And it's not helpful. Not helpful. I'm not a physician. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm a healthcare administrator. I just know that in order for us to have a reasonable way to proceed in facilities such as mine, I've got to have a way of knowing what's happening on this campus. And that requires testing.
Now, you've got a 40-acre campus at River Garden. And as you said, nobody's going in or out except staff. When staff come onto your campus and they interact with the seniors there, what sorts of precautions is everyone taking to try to prevent the spread of COVID?
So we have virtually no mingling of our independent living and skilled nursing facility residents, virtually none. Staff are wearing masks. They're all wearing surgical masks whenever they're engaged in any activities with a resident. So right now, at the moment, as I'm speaking to you, I'm sitting out on the porch outside of my office without a mask on. But otherwise, staff are wearing masks. And we've restricted movement around the building. I mean, it's hard. It's really hard. But you are correct. At this point now, travel in and on and off of our campus is overwhelmingly by staff.
Right. Here's an email on a comment on our Facebook page. Susan says, do you support a more active monitoring of people testing positive? Should the city provide hotel rooms to help people quarantine who test positive? What do you think, Marty?
I don't know. I know that within our facility, we have separate areas now designated for anyone coming in from, I mean, I think I've had 5 admissions in the last 4 weeks from hospital. And again, those people all would have been tested for COVID prior to admission. And then they're going on to a discrete unit where they are quarantined in their room for 14 days. And that's worked for us. We also have set up another area in our facility, another wing, for anyone who might show any respiratory issue at all. And so we would move them onto this other area where we would be prepared to house somebody with the virus if that was presented to us. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, sure. Let's go to Tom on the west side. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. I just wanted to share this caution that the numbers really do not reveal the whole story. My cousin was the one who just passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was probably as healthy a man as any in any nursing home. And so it can strike just about anybody. If they're exposed, it can take you down.
How old was your cousin, Tom?
I believe he was 80. I'm not sure exactly.
Okay.
Like I say, he's the one that just passed away.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. And, you know, here's an email from a listener. He wants to know, of the 35 deaths in our area, what was the age of those who died? And for those who were under age 65, did they have vulnerable medical conditions? You know, Marty, the majority of people who are passing away are seniors. Younger right. people who have died of COVID sometimes have an underlying medical condition, but not always. Perfectly right. healthy people who are not senior citizens have passed away, although they are not the majority of cases by any means. And so to Tom's point, the caller, you can be in really good physical shape. You can be taking every precaution. You can still get sick. And that, I think, is why everybody is so desperate for more protective equipment and, as you've been saying, more testing.
Correct. You know, it's also the case that you look at what's happened in the New York City metropolitan area, where doctors and nurses and healthcare personnel are coming down with the virus, and they are well protected. Okay, they're wearing respirator masks. They're wearing shields. I mean, this virus is particularly transmissible. It's stunning, actually, Melissa, in its transmissibility. I think Dr. Fauci has commented on that. It's stunning in how easily it is transmitted from one individual to another. And so really and truly, in the absence of a vaccine, what we need to be doing is practicing social distance, you know, I was about to say isolation, but we need to be staying 5, 6, 7 feet apart. That's the single most significant thing we can do, and wash our hands every time we pass an opportunity to do that.
And what else, before we let you go, what else do you think senior living centers, long-term care facilities will be doing in the coming weeks to try to better address this crisis for their residents and staff?
I think we're going to continue to see more of the same, frankly. My hope is that I'm wrong, and that we're not opening up the economy too soon, and that we're not going to see a rebound of this virus, because if we do, it's going to hit us really hard, everybody. But I mean, I see this continuing, certainly for senior facilities, well into the next month.
At the very least, yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I want to thank you, Marty, for appearing with us and for keeping your population safe down there in Mandarin. He's Marty Goetz, CEO of River Garden, Hebrew Home for the Aged, and River Garden Senior Services. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And there's much more still to come on the show. Up next.
This year, we've decided to structure our season around music that we know Jacksonville will love.
Something to look forward to, the return of the Jacksonville Symphony as they release their new season. A conversation with music director Courtney Lewis coming up. Also, we'll look at how you can find out if your business is covered for COVID-19 losses. That's coming up too. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
The Voidcast from WJCT and Void Magazine is a Northeast Florida musical journey into the Allman Brothers Band's formative period in Jacksonville.
It was just like, you know, I'm hearing this magic being born.
The bedrooms where locals are making pop music in isolation.
I play everything on this keyboard.
Northeast Florida's hip-hop scene, where women and queer people are claiming their space.
We kind of were tokenized to kind of be like the openers.
Hear it at wjct.org/voidcast, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and Electro Lounge Radio 89.9 FM HD4 celebrates the heritage and history of jazz every Sunday from sunrise to sunset. So tune in to Electro Lounge Radio 89.9 FM HD4 or online at wjct.org/jacksmusic and explore the roots of jazz from old favorites to fresh new jazz. We play it all every Sunday on Electro Lounge Radio. Jazz, America's original art form, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, before you know it, the Jacksonville Symphony will be back and performing on stage. They've released the highlights of their upcoming season, too. I spoke about it with the symphony's music director, Courtney Lewis. Let's listen. Courtney Lewis, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you too, Melissa.
And we're all looking forward to another season of wonderful music at the Jacksonville Symphony. We will have to wait a little longer to all gather in person, but there is a new season to talk about. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So whereas last season focused on the music of Beethoven, this year we've decided to structure our season around music that we know Jacksonville will love. So there are lots of favorites that people can look forward to. Dvorak's Ninth Symphony, Sanson's Organ Symphony. We start with Bruckner's Fifth. We also welcome back a lot of soloists who we've loved in the past years. Joshua Roman returns, the wonderful cellist, to play the Prokofiev Sinfonia Concertante. We have Jean-Yves Thiboudet, the international star pianist, coming for our gala. And we also are looking forward to inviting Colin Curry, the wonderful English percussionist, to open the season for us in fanfare in September. So this is something that we can really look forward to right now in these difficult times, a season full of the joy of music that will lift our spirits.
Absolutely. And the big kickoff fanfare is set for Saturday, September 26th. It's right. A ways off, and by that time we all anticipate that we can meet in large groups again. And it's tough right now not being able to do that. But we can mark that date on the calendar and look ahead, right?
I hope so. I really do. That's certainly how I'm looking at it at the moment. Putting all our energy into making sure that next season is something that the city can really embrace and enjoy and be inspired by.
And there's so much coming up after the opening, as you said. If people go to jacksymphony.org, they can see everything that's on tap. The gala in March, the Nutcracker and Handel's Messiah at the holidays, the movie series.
Movie series is great. Something I'm particularly excited about is that we're bringing opera back again. So any of you who saw our production of Don Giovanni, which featured projections on the back wall and a set built on top of the orchestra, that same setup will be coming back for La Bohème by Puccini, which we're very excited about.
That's exciting. And has it been a while since you've done this? How common has this been over the years?
Well, we've only done it once before, 2 years ago. This last season we didn't do it just because we were going to D.C. instead, and that was the big project. But we're excited to be bringing it back next year. So it'll be the second original production in this style.
Okay. And in this downtime, what else is going through your mind as you prepare for the fall?
Well, I've been spending an awful lot of time studying music. It's nice in some ways to have time to step back from performances. I've been playing a lot of piano. I've been making an awful lot of videos, different groups of people, just to show that we're still here. The orchestra is still in the community. Obviously, it's a very difficult time for performers because we can't give any performances. But we're looking forward to the future and being able to be back serving everybody with great music.
Just go to jacksymphony.org and mark your calendar now for the opening of the 2020-21 season of the Jacksonville Symphony. It will be Courtney's sixth on the podium. Courtney Lewis, he is the Symphony and Music Director. Always good to talk to you. And thank you so much for sharing all this with us.
It's my pleasure, Melissa. See you soon.
And in a moment, advice for business owners seeking to make sure their COVID-19 losses are covered in this pandemic. We'll be right back. Well, businesses across the First Coast have, of course, shuttered their doors because of coronavirus, and some are turning to commercial insurance policies they've paid into for years, but they're being told their losses aren't covered. What about that? Well, attorneys Bradley Botiford and Wayne Hogan from the Terrell Hogan Firm are here now to discuss how you can find out if your business is covered for COVID-19. They also have some thoughts about some other legal issues related to this. Hi, Bradley and Wayne.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Melissa.
Good morning to both of you. And Bradley, let's start with you. How do you know if you're a business owner, if you're covered for losses related to this pandemic?
Sure. The first place to start is to review your commercial insurance policy. I can't emphasize that enough. And I understand that many of these commercial insurance policies are going to be over 100 pages in length, and that may be intimidating to some. So if you don't feel comfortable reviewing those policies yourself, feel free to reach out to an attorney or someone else that you trust. To kind of emphasize that point, many might think if their fire ruined their business and burned it to the ground, they've been paying commercial insurance on that for many times, and they would certainly review their contract afterwards. Here, this business interruption that's affecting thousands of businesses in our community, this situation is no different for many of them. Many businesses have lost the income overnight, and it's the same income that they've had and been paying insurance coverage for many years.
Sure. And so what happens then if you go to your insurance company, make a claim, and they deny it? What then?
Sure. There's kind of three steps. Like we first talked about, the first step is to review your policy, and you just suggested that many insurance companies may not approve once you give the notice or file a claim. And if that is the case, that kind of will lead many businesses to the third and final step, and that is if the insurance company unfairly denies their claim, then their last course of action would be to seek release in the courts, to have a judge or a jury to decide if they actually do have a grant of coverage that would give them the protections that they need.
And how much of a surge of these types of lawsuits do you anticipate we're going to see?
Thousands and thousands of local businesses here in the Jacksonville area, just like across the rest of the United States, have been paying their commercial insurance premiums for years. And now we're in a financial crisis, and they need help like many other people. Many of those businesses have purchased what is called business interruption or civil authority closure or civil authority ingress, egress insurance protect them from crisis just like this. And they're in all three phases of the process like we talked about. Some people are just now reviewing their contracts for the first time. Some haven't gotten around to that yet. Some have given notice of a claim to their insurance companies and are waiting to hear back to see if they will be granted coverage or not. And some have already filed suit in court. We've seen some of those court cases thus far. And we anticipate thousands more will be filed in Florida as well as across the United States in the coming months.
Sure. And Wayne Hogan, let's turn to you now. As Governor DeSantis assembles a task force of business leaders, we've learned today that we'll look at opening Florida's economy. Up in Georgia, the governor there, Brian Kemp, has said he wants to open up nail salons, gyms, other businesses this week. Do you have concerns about that?
Well, everybody wants to get the economy moving again, but do it safely. And, you know, over the years, you and I have talked about small businesses protecting their bottom line by having safety policies in place. Particularly, you and I have talked about distracted driving and the need to prevent people from using phones while they're on the job and out on the road. But we need to look more broadly than that. Policies need to be in place like the companies had in place before this pandemic. And when they do that, have to realize they may have lost employees, they may have lost supervisors. And in that situation, they need to be very careful to see that the policies of safety that they had in place and that the employees followed before this pandemic, as they get up to speed again, they need to make sure they follow the same safety policies in order to protect not just the employees or anybody else, but also the bottom line of the company. So it's very easy to say, let's get going. But you have to realize that those safety policies were in place. Those programs made a difference and kept their employees safe. And going forward, as we get going again, they need to do the very same thing. See that the policy is reviewed, see that the new supervisors and employees are trained, and then that helps to protect the business from doing damage to itself while it tries to come up out of this pandemic.
Right. Now, as Bradley mentioned, court cases are expected to surge. That could clog up the court system overall. As an attorney, how have you been observing the court system functioning during this crisis?
Well, We're very fortunate in this area to have a judiciary that is determined to see that things keep moving. We had a there's a group called the American Board of Trial Advocates, and the Jacksonville chapter had a video seminar the other day. We had Chief Judge Mahan for the Fourth Circuit. We had the Chief Administrative Judge in the civil area to come on the line. That's Judge Del Wallace. Also, we had Don Lester for Clay County Circuit Courts. We also had Judge Jim Daniel for Nassau County. And United States District Judge Howard was on the phone on the call as well. Both, every one of those judges made it clear the courts are up and running. They're having hearings by video conference and by telephone. They've actually had bench trials, that's without a jury, that are ongoing. And many people may not realize that Florida was actually ahead of the other states with electronic filing. So even though the courthouse itself may be closed, lawyers can file cases for individuals, whether it's a personal injury and wrongful death case or a business versus insurance company case, such as Bradley was discussing. Those cases can be filed. The defendants have to answer. Then videotape depositions, pretrial testimony is being taken. Documents are being produced. So the judges across the state, because of an order by the Chief Justice, are moving cases along. The only problem is, of course, that right now we can't have jury trials because of the social distancing requirement. But the general public needs to know that the court system is up and running, and if they have problems and they consult a lawyer, that lawyer is able to pursue their case and then take it through the process all the way up to the potential for jury trial. But even mediations are taking place, often by video conference, such as Zoom, that you discussed earlier. And so we're lucky that we have such a determined judicial system to where our judges want to make sure that we have an opportunity to resolve disputes in a civil fashion. Of course, the criminal courts have the same issue, and they'll get back eventually to jury trials as well. But the judges are having hearings, and that really matters.
Yeah, it does. And more about insurance claims for COVID is at terrellhogan.com. You can check that out there and get in touch with the attorneys. Bradley Botiford with us today and Wayne Hogan, both bringing us up to date on these legal issues. Guys, I really want to thank you for joining us and stay safe. Thanks again.
Melissa, thank you.
Thanks to you both. Full disclosure, the Terrell Hogan Firm is a sponsor here at WJCT. And up next, we're going to take a listen to Voidcast. It's part of our brand new Jacksonville music experience. Don't go away.
Cavendish Partners PA and Michael Cavendish, a law practice supporting Jacksonville's business community, downtown, by appointment, and on the web at cavpartners.com. WJCT thanks the following business partners for their generous support. Ansbacher Law PA, 1748 Bakehouse. For more information, contact Anna Marie Stanford at 358-6390.
On the next Fresh Air, Jennifer Finney Boylan, who's written extensively about her life as a transgender woman, talks about her new memoir, Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs. It's about seven phases of her life and the dogs she loved during each phase. In her New York Times op-ed column, she's been writing about her life during the pandemic. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Oil is having a storage crisis. A whole lot of it isn't being used, so oil tankers are being paid just to sit there and hold oil.
We have an armada of vessels that are stationary for 2 weeks now.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How AI and big data could help track that storage problem. We'll tell you more next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Live concerts are part of our social fabric. They help connect us to the bands and musicians we love. But with the global concert industry at a standstill, fans are finding new ways to support their favorite artists. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll find out how and hear why 2020 could be the year that changes the live music scene forever. That's next time on the Always Ticket-Free 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, WJCT just launched a brand new podcast. It's part of our new multi-platform initiative, the Jacksonville Music Experience. This is a great podcast, and it's called Voidcast. Take a listen.
Northeast Florida has its fingerprints all over the history of popular music, from the rock and roll explosion of the 1960s, hip-hop in the 90s, whatever this was, and currently, local artists are making noise that's reverberating across the country.
It's You Know live on KEXP. Take it away.
I'm Matt Shaw, editor of the Jacksonville culture and lifestyle magazine, Void. I've been playing and writing about music for years, and now I'm hosting this, the Voidcast.
Well, I figured instead of traveling around playing shows, I could just, like, kind of travel around the internet sharing my music.
Is hip-hop a particularly masculine art form?
Yeah, man, let's be real. Let's be real. Life is like a box of
chocolates, you won't know. Skinner, baby.
Freebird. It's more of an inspiration to us than the Allman Brothers. I'm just kidding.
While we were, like, rebinding Bibles, we listened to the Allman Brothers.
It's on your face, it's perfect.
I found that although we have these modern streaming services and discovery radio stations putting millions of songs into our pockets just a click and a strong Wi-Fi signal away, it actually can be harder than ever to discover local music. And that's what I want to do with the Voidcast. We're cutting through the digital noise, subverting the algorithms in this locals-only musical journey through Northeast Florida. With the help of local musicians.
What's up, friends? Can I get y'all to just bob your heads?
Producers.
I play everything on this keyboard.
And the people who lived local music history.
I wanted to marry George Harrison. I think I came pretty close. The walls around
here again. This is the Voidcast, produced by WJCT. Play it loud, or play it at a reasonable volume. Just play it local.
Good stuff. Void editor Matt Shaw is on the line and our own podcast producer and host, Lindsay Kilbride. Hi, guys. Good morning.
Morning.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to have you. Matt, this is such a great new offering at WJCT. You've really just discovered so much local musical talent. Tell us who made the cut and how you chose them and how you were able to highlight the music scene here.
Yeah, I think... we were kind of just looking around at things that weren't really being talked about, but things that kind of had made maybe national headlines or something. Like, for example, like, you know, an artist we talked to who was making music in his bedroom in Arlington, and he was discovered, signed to Sub Pop, which is very cool, Seattle-based record label. And nobody had ever heard of him here, and then he was, like, blowing up, had millions of listens on Spotify. And then Allman Brothers, of course, like, we felt like they were kind of underappreciated here, but people know that they spent time here, but we didn't really know the full story. And then hip hop, obviously, well, obvious to a lot of people, has kind of been, the lifeblood of the city's music scene for a long time. And, so we wanted to kind of dive in and see what was going on there. Mm-hmm. right now. So, yeah. I mean, it was kind of like we initially thought we were going to do, an endless amount of episodes. But, you know, with the coronavirus pandemic and stuff, we kind of got cut.
That's right. And Lindsay, can you talk about that quickly? This may be a mini series for Voidcast, right?
Yeah, we're still figuring out what the overall what it'll be overall, but yeah, I mean this is it for right now, but that doesn't mean there won't be more episodes in the future. We're still figuring that out, but either way, this is like a pretty well done mini series that touches on many different themes. And you know what I think is really cool about it is that like a music podcast is just sort of a broad statement, but like Matt really has this expertise that I haven't really seen anywhere else. So someone like me who doesn't have a lot of like music knowledge thinks these are just really, really interesting stories with really good characters, but then also like Matt's a musician and he's really figuring out answering questions that he personally has with someone who knows a lot about the local music scene. So I think even musicians will find this really interesting.
I really do. Yeah, it's so great. And even if you aren't a big music person, you should take a listen to Voidcast because you will learn a lot about this community and how talented performers are in our area. So I want to thank you, Matt Shaw, for hosting Voidcast. It's up at wjct.org/JaxMusic, part of our new Jacksonville Music Experience platform. Lindsay Kilbride produced it and produces so many great podcasts here. Thank you both so much for this. It's great to talk to you both. Hope to see you again in person soon.
Thank you, WJCT.
Thanks, guys. And we're going to close with Sunlight by Yuno. He is spotlighted on the Voidcast. He's from Jacksonville, and he's become a Spotify sensation. This is Sunlight. Enjoy. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.